Hey, this is Alex Terranova, and this is the Dream Mason Podcast. We've been taught to behave, to fit in, to follow the rules, but Dream Masons reject conventional thought. Dream Masons are rebels. They take a chisel to the marble that is typical traditional life. They carve out brilliance and broadcast it to the world. Join me for another chapter as we unmask convention, embrace the rebels within us, and more deeply come to explore the complex and agitated edges of our existence. Now, before we get started, please don't be a rebel yet and grab your phone and hit that little button that says subscribe. Thank you. Because your dreams don't build themselves. What's up? And welcome back to the Dream Mason Podcast. I am your host, Alex Terranova. Today's episode, I want to share a little bit about my history with investing. I want to talk a little about the idea of investing. And then we're going to introduce our guest today who, I'm just going to say, he's an expert on investing. I don't know if there's a metric that determines expert, but based on his background and what he's done, I would say he's got value and information that a lot of us can learn from. And I'm doing this specifically because I realized right before we flipped on the mics today that I don't think we've ever talked about this on this podcast. We've touched the gamut of things from different industries and things people have overcome, but I don't think we've ever talked about investing. And in a year like 2020, your investments could essentially make or break you. So I'll share a little bit about my history. So my history with investing has been, it's kind of been a hit or miss kind of thing. So in my early 20s, I invested in two properties with a friend that was like killing it in the real estate market. This is pre-2008. The first one we flipped, made a bunch of money. Like, I didn't know what I was doing, but I put my trust and faith in a buddy who I really trusted. And I think that was a key component. I knew he wasn't going to run away with my money. I knew he knew what he was doing. And so I had a lot of faith. And I also knew that our friendship mattered more to him than the money that we would or wouldn't make, which for me was a key. Like, you know, I knew if he took 20 grand or 50 grand from, like, he wouldn't do that to bankrupt our relationship. So I think that was like a great early lesson. And then our second house, we actually didn't make money. The 2008 hit, we turned this property into like this beautiful property. And we actually didn't make money seemingly because of the circumstances of the world. But yet it was a great learning experience. We didn't take that big of a hit either. And again, I knew that in that process, even in the process of not doing well, I had a friend that I could trust. And if he ever came to me again with an investment, you'd probably have to convince me why not to do it than why I would do it. It'd be a lot easier to convince me to do it. He wouldn't have to say much. I would trust him. And same thing, you know, when I've had a lot of investments in the stock market, and I think the success there has been the same thing, like having advocates on my side. I'm not a stock market expert. So having someone who's watching my money that I know I can trust. And again, I know I can trust them because of longevity. They've worked with family members. They've worked with other people. I know they call me to see how I'm doing out of nowhere. Don't ask for money. Just to check in. They're like, oh, can I listen to your podcast? It feels like, even though we work together, they feel like a family member. And again, I believe that at the end of the day, the relationship matters more than the money. And that seems to be the theme when I'm investing. Does relationship matter more than money? Because I think if money matters more than relationship, then there's more likelihood that you're going to get taken or screwed or you're not going to like the way it goes, right? Not every investment's going to work out. And so I think we need to understand that we're not going to hit a home run every time we're up, but if the relationship's solid, then we want to go up to the plate more. And if I look at other investments, I invested in a tech company probably 10 years ago, and we thought it was going to be one of those home runs. Like me and my brother, when we were investing the money, we were like calculating out how much money we'd have if, you know, the company sold for what imaginary amount that might sell for. And we were like, what would we buy? And, you know, we were in our 20s when we did this. And now 10 years later, the company still exists. I still have the investment, but it has not blown up. And my investment is essentially the same as it was. So I haven't lost it. I've lost money in the sense of time has passed, but I haven't lost any money in the sense of my money's still there. And look, the company could still sell, something could still happen with it. And maybe one day I do get paid. But I thought that was a great lesson in, man, don't count your, like, you know, your, I don't even know the old saying. It's like, don't count your sheep, I guess, or whatever. But basically, like, we started living in that fantasy of like, oh, this thing's going to sell. I'm going to be millionaires. I'm going to buy beach houses. And even though we didn't lose anything, I think we were a little bummed. Like, where's our money? Even though that's not how. And now I'm now into my 30s. I'm like really focused on real estate. And I'm looking at how to spread my money out. Can I put like a little bit of money in this real estate deal? Can I put another little bit in this real estate deal? And maybe I'm just collecting a return, like a monthly return. The stock market's been really good to me and I feel really lucky about that. And I would say one of the things I've also learned is I tried to invest in the stock market on my own. And that was a nice little slap in the face. Like, you can't just go throw your money and be like, you know, even companies like Apple go up and down. They don't just, it's not just up, 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 up. And often I'll have clients that I'll say something like, I lost a bunch of money in the stock market and they're really upset. And it's like a reminder, hey, if the thing only went up, it wouldn't be the stock market, right? If you could only gamble and win, we'd all be gambling. It wouldn't exist. That if you're gonna play, you better be prepared to lose just as much as you'd like to win. All that being said, I do strongly believe to the my wins and my losses and the things that I've, you know, the lessons I've learned, there's no better thing that I could do with my money than invest it in other things, because then maybe I don't have to wake up to go to a job, or I don't have to worry about, am I getting clients or not? I'm actually getting money while I sleep. That to me is why I want to invest and why I think people should be more focused on how they can use their money to make money, instead of having to use their time to make money. Let's get into my guest today, because he's gonna teach us likely a lot more if I can pull this information out of him, and he'll give us his secrets. He has a sword in the background of his video, so I don't want to get too make him upset. But my guest today, so he was the youngest senior VP at Bank of America and managed over $1 trillion of asset management. He's also the former head of distribution of Alumni Venture Group. Is it Alumni Venture Group Management?
Yes. Is that what it's called? So okay. Just call it AVG, Alumni Venture Group. So it's a venture capital fund, correct?
Cool. Thank you. Now you're hearing the voice of Pierre Rogers, the guest. He's also the founder and CEO of Yayin, and he's an angel investor. He's a father, a husband. And from what I'm learning about him, he's definitely someone who we can take information about how to use our money to make more money. Pierre, welcome to the Dream Mason podcast. Thanks for correcting me on that company name. I appreciate the help.
Alex, so excited to be here, man. This is going to be a lot of fun.
How are you? You told me right before we started, I would love for you to share, like, how are you? How's your 2020 going?
I'm doing fantastic. Most importantly, my family is doing well. Business for us is up in a significant way this year, partially because of luck, partially because of smart decision making. And if you, I would love to talk about the sword in the background, because people ask about it all the time.
Sure. What's up with the sword?
So the sword in the background is to commemorate a very famous poem by Basho. Basho is arguably the most famous poet to ever come out of ancient Japan. And basically what the sword is to represent is this poem, this haiku. And in this haiku, it basically talks about the frivolity of man, meaning that all these samurais come together and they clash on this big battlefield and all this bloodshed happens and all this death happens. But tomorrow the grass grows and the sun comes alive. And your life is a little bit meaningless. Your death was meaningless. And that's not, you can take that in one of two ways. You can say, oh my God, that's terrible and depressing and what have you. I, and what the poem is meant to give you is, that's massive freedom. It's massive amount of freedom, right? So now you can be free to go and take that risk. And so that sword behind me is to dedicate to that poem. It always reminds me, like, whenever I'm being uncomfortable or scared or I don't want to put myself out there, I remember that we're all going to be dead soon and it's not really going to matter. And so if I'm embarrassed or someone tells me to pound sand, ultimately it doesn't matter.
That reminds me so much. I'm going to look up that poem. I've never heard of it, but the mindset around it reminds me of, I used to live my life negative, pessimistic, judging everything. And like, I had a good life. Let's not be mistaken. I was extraordinarily privileged. My life was probably top 10% of people in the world. But the way I viewed my life, it was never good enough. I was pissed off. I was angry. I kept a lot bottled in. And over the last 6 years, I've done a lot of work to change that. And now I'm like, my life is extraordinary. Is it that much different than it was 6 years ago? No, I didn't make like $1 billion. I don't have a yacht. I'm not living in a Playboy mansion. My life is, yes, there are things that are better. I've done some things, but it's not like two polar opposites. It's not like I went from, you know, the slums to a mansion and everything's. What changed was the mindset about it, right? Instead of looking at it from like, oh, this like, you know, that the death and the destruction and all the bad stuff, I started looking at the opportunities and what's possible and being grateful and all the blessings. And to the same point, I think I used to do the judgment and the negativity because it kept me safe. Yes. I couldn't, right? Like you've heard people like, hey, don't have expectations because you'll be disappointed. It's like not taking shots. Well, you can't make them if you don't take them, right?
That's exactly right. Yes.
And yeah, so if you want to live your life on perpetual defense, that's great. But the likelihood of ever scoring is pretty limited.
Yes.
And thanks for letting that show up in this space, because somebody said to me, oh, lucky you the other day, your life is so great. And I was like, well, okay, first of all, I've done like a lot of work. Now, I'm not one to not acknowledge I'm very lucky. You know, where I was born, who I was born to, the situations, total privilege. And the work I've mostly done is just the mindset, because I could still be that other guy in the same situation. 100%. And what you said is it's freedom. I feel so much more free every day.
Yes, very much.
How do you teach this? Because I kind of touched on you're married and you have kids. How do you try to ingrain that kind of mindset into your kids?
So it's a two-step plan. So my kids are very small right now. And so what I do is when they come home for school, I ask them in a very excited tone, what mistakes did you make today? Like I'm pumped to hear about their mistakes.
Yeah.
And they'll be like, oh, Dad, like I did a math test, but I got two questions wrong. I'd be like, oh, what happened with those two questions? Like, oh, I didn't do it right because I forgot this or what happened. I'm like, oh, that's so awesome. What did you, then that means you learned something. What did you learn, right? And we go down that path. And so I always ask him at the end of this little talk, I go, great, why is Dad excited that you made a mistake? And they go, because it means I'm trying. That's all I care about. It means you're putting yourself out there, you're pushing, you're trying something new, it's uncomfortable. Don't be afraid of that uncomfortable. That's the value. So with my kids, that's what I do there, because there's too little to work on sort of the physicality of it. But there's a few people that I guess you would say mentor, although it's not a formal relationship or anything. They just kind of hit me up for advice and I try to walk them through it. And one kid in particular, his mom's addicted to meth. His dad's not around. He's in his 20s. He lives at home. Life is crappy, like, you know, bad job, like just as bad as it possibly can be. And he reaches out to me. He's like, Pierre, I always find that I have negative self-talk. Like I put myself down. And I always feel pity. And I said, okay, dude. And he's in his 20s. This little thing won't work for everybody. I said, what you need to do is every time you catch yourself doing negative self-talk, drop down and do 5 push-ups. Not 50 push-ups, just 5. Yeah. That's all I need you to do, right? And I said, the hard part isn't the 5 push-ups. Anybody could do 5 push-ups. The hard part is going, I just said stuff to myself that I shouldn't have said. Now I got to get down on the ground like a knucklehead and do these 5 push-ups is something I don't want to do. It's not about the physicality. It's about training your brain to rewire to not do the thing you keep doing, right? That's the trick here. It's not about doing push-ups. It's about, I don't want to do push-ups. Ugh, I just said something stupid to myself. Get down, bang out 5 push-ups. You do that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times a day. Not only did you do 30 push-ups that day, but also your brain starts to being like, no, that's not how I should think, right? And over time, you build new neural pathways and it changes your life completely.
Absolutely. I love, like, I think about all the time, the idea that how often do you, I'm sure you hear this. I hear it all the time where people are like, oh, I know I shouldn't do that. Or I know better. Or, like they have this moment where they're realizing they know they're doing the thing that's not serving them, but then they don't take a different action. They just kind of like say it. It's like,
yes.
And it's like, we know, but nothing will change just because you know it. We all know ways to like get healthier, lose weight, get in better shape.
Right.
But how many of us are actually taking action to make those changes?
Bingo. That's exactly right. So self-awareness is the first step. So you're aware that you just did something stupid. You said something bad to yourself and that's not healthy. That's great. But the next step is taking action. Like you said, how are you going to rewire your brain? And for most people, a physical activity is the best thing because it actually tricks your body into releasing dopamine into your system, right? So you're actually using a drug that your own body produces to help you rewire. It sounds like a bunch of kind of woo-woo stuff. It's not. I mean, this has been proven over and over at Cambridge University in England, Harvard Business School, MIT did brain scans about this. It's incredibly meaningful. And I cite this quick article, and I'll be brief here.
Please.
Cambridge University did a research on luck. Mm-hmm. And they said they took three groups of people, three groups of 10. One group thought they were very, very lucky. Another group thought they were very unlucky. And one group had sort of no feelings about it. It was the control group. And the two tests I remember the most. So they were all the groups were asked, each person was asked to read this 500-page book in one day. It's a monumental task. But what people didn't realize is at the bottom of page two, it said, you don't have to read all 500 pages. 9 out of 10 people that considered themselves lucky read it, understood it, put the book down. Of the people who were unlucky, 9 out of 10 people tried to read the whole book. Then they flipped it around. This is a better one. They said, okay, you guys are done here. Head off to the bus stop and whatever it was, the taxi line, whatever yeah. It was. It was 50 feet, very short distance. And there was 100 pounds on the ground, a 100-pound bill, right? This is in the UK. So basically a $100 bill sitting on the ground between where they were and the bus stop. And each person had to go individually. And the statistics were the same. Lucky people, 9 out of 10 found the $100 bill. Of the unlucky people, 9 out of 10 didn't find the $100 bill. Because what happens is your brain looks for its own biases. Republicans watch Fox News, Democrats watch CNN because they want to confirm their own biases. If you believe, if your bias is that you are lucky, then your brain seeks to find luck. If you believe you are unlucky, it seeks to destroy luck. It literally is that simple. I would argue that most people won't actually take that process to rewire their brain to believe that they are lucky to actually find those opportunities.
You just touched on so many cool things. So I want to like add on to some of this. So I lean Democrat or I lean left, but I also have like lots, like I own a gun. I have things on both sides. I have beliefs on both sides, right? Like I think that if you're on the extremes often, we're creating like extremes typically don't create good situations.
Nope.
typically it's the gray or the colors, not the black or the white that we actually get. We all can win in the gray, whereas we can't win. So I know that I lean like one direction. And I know that when I watch CNN, I will have a lot of my biases confirmed. I purposely watch Fox News on a regular basis. If I'm going to watch the news, I don't watch that much news. And I go to foxnews.com. If I'm looking. And one of the things that I've noticed, which I actually love, look, there's some biases that are confirmed, right? I see things and I'm like, this is crazy. Yep. And they'll say something and I'll go, whoa, I never thought of it like that. Yep. And then all of a sudden, I can actually be more balanced. It's like I can also look at like some of the friends that are on the left and go, wait a minute, hey, what you're saying is actually hypocritical. Because of something I learned that I had needed a different perspective. And I can do the same thing to people on both sides.
Yes.
Which to me, this isn't about which side is right or wrong. It's expanding what I know, right? My brain, my bandwidth is getting bigger. Mm-hmm. The other thing you said, which I'm curious to see if you see this in your life. The more work I've done on this, like, changing my neural pathways, like things from meditation to reading books to having conversations with people like you to catching my thoughts and changing my behavior, I'm now, and it took a couple of years, right? It didn't happen overnight. I'm now almost can see myself from like outside, mm-hmm. and I'll go, something bad will happen. And I'm saying bad, like liberally is in the sense something will go not as I wanted. A client will leave. A client will leave, a deal will fall through. And Alex of old would have been like, why does this always happen? It's all going to fall apart now. Like it was always like when's the other shoe going to drop? Yeah. And now a client, let's say a client leaves, I'll go, ooh, who's going to show up to take their place? Like I'm excited for the next one. Or a deal will fall through and I'm like, a better deal's coming. And I'll see myself saying it and going, holy shit, that's new neural pathways. I'm not pretending. I'm not faking that. It's actually, it might've started with a little bit of like faking and pushing. Oh. And now it's real to the point of, I just had a deal fall through the other day and my cousin calls me and goes, dude, come on. You're going to get like a Ferrari is like going to fall in your lap. We laughed about it. And I was like, ah, man, I'm the luckiest guy. She goes, you should go jump off a building and test your theory. Obviously I'm not going to do that. But I love the example. I've never heard of either of those studies. And I love the idea that luck is simply a factor of what you're open to and what you're looking for.
Yes.
How do you see it in your actual life? Like, where does it play out?
It plays out in the two things that I think are arguably the most important to find business success, happiness, relationship, get promoted. There's two qualities and they're intrinsically linked. One is intellectual honesty. You just demonstrated intellectual honesty because you said, this is my bias over here, but I'm aware of said bias. So I want to go fact check my biases. And I do that by sort of looking at, in this case, you use Fox News as sort of the opposite. And you were also aware of, hey, they make some good points over here, right? Here's a good argument for intellectual honesty. For anybody who is hardcore Democrat or hardcore Republican who wants their team, irrespective of which one, to win all of the time, right? They want them to be the president, the House of Representatives, the senators, everything. If you look at actual statistics from the various states that vote that way, there are clearly shortcomings that are different on both sides, right? Blue states have higher crime, higher homeless rate, and failing infrastructure. They do. Red states have poor healthcare and poor education systems. Mm-hmm. Right? So those are the negatives. Now you can flip it around and go to the positives. Blue states have better education systems, better hospitals. Red states have lower crime, much lower crime, much lower homeless populations. So that, what does that tell you? It tells you that that problems are complex mm-hmm. and you should have intellectual honesty to go, my team doesn't have the answers to everything.
Yeah.
The other side, I'm talking to both sides here, isn't evil. Okay, it's not really? The Hatfield and McCoys.
We should say that again. Like there's not, it's not the evil empire and the like the Jedi. It's right.
No, it is not right. And you can make that argument over and over again. So intellectual honesty is one, and I have one that I don't necessarily feel comfortable sharing on the podcast because it's a little controversial. But it's an example that Republicans and Democrats both agree and disagree on simultaneously.
Sure.
I feel like I need to share it because it hopefully will get people just thinking. Republicans believe that all life is precious, so they tend to be pro-life. Mm-hmm. Unless you go to jail and then we'll kill you.
Yes.
Democrats believe that it's a woman's right to choose the life of her child, so you can have abortion. But once that baby is born, all life is precious, don't kill them.
Yes. Yeah.
But that doesn't make any sense, right? You know that's a conflict of ideal, right? You should either be like, you should either be more binary in this case, like either A, life, all life is precious, meaning we never murder anybody ever, mm-hmm. whether it's an abortion or because they're a mass murderer in jail, right? That's one of the sort of Buddhist mentality. Or you believe in another mentality, which is we need to look at these things more objectively and say, well, in certain cases, maybe they were a mass murderer, they probably don't deserve to live. It made me make that judgment, or she was raped and doesn't want to have the baby, right? So now we get into the point of this sort of controversial thing I just said, which is the intellectual honesty is that those two ideas kind of cross swords. Maybe we need to realize that problems are complex and they take complex and nuanced solutions to solve them, right? It's not a bullet point. And so switching gears for a quick second, the last thing I'll just say is intellectual curiosity. If you're not curious, then you're never going to move ahead in business. You're never going to get promoted. And frankly, you're probably not going to have a lot of great relationships. You have to be that person who wants to learn more. And chances are, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably are that person, right? So you're on that good path. But that intellectual honesty and intellectual curiosity, those two factors mean more than your net worth, where you went to school, all of those things. If you have those two things, you're going to be phenomenal in life.
I'm often surprised. I don't know how often you're meeting like new people, but I'm often surprised the things people don't know. And I don't know if it's education or lack of curiosity. I read a lot, so I feel like I know a lot, because it's not that it's all true, but I read a lot, so I know a lot of things. But I'll say things like, hey, have you heard about this group of people? And people are like, no, you know, and have you heard about this theory? And people, and I'm often surprised, because we can't know everything, right? There's the pie is humongous.
Right.
But I think that it's interesting. What my experience is that most people know the little bit that they know, and they keep trying to learn more about that little 1%. And they're like, become experts on 1% versus like, I know a little bit about a lot of things. And I might not be an expert on any of these 100 things I know about, but I know a little bit about all of them. And and because of that, I can actually learn more, because I can have conversations about it.
Yes.
Which I hear is like the intellectual curiosity, but it's also the opportunity to understand the issues. Mm-hmm. You brought up a controversial point that growing up in Los Angeles, like I automatically was always for like a woman's right to choose. And as a man, I was like, why do I even need to be in this conversation? Right. And then I dated somebody who was very conservative and on the right. And I was like, I just want to understand, like, as a woman also, why would you not want to have women have choice of their bodies? And they explained to me the idea that like they believe that as soon as a baby's conceived, that's a life. Mm-hmm. And when they explained it, I went, okay, like I wouldn't want to take a life. Like I can understand that. Now, I love that your point, like it's not a black or a white, because I still believe that I, as a man, don't need to be involved in this conversation. Mm. And I also still believe that like a woman should get to decide. It's her, like I wouldn't want, and look, we could do this with anything, right? I don't want to be told I should have to do a vaccine, or like I should have to take a drug, or like I should have to drink water that comes out of my sink if it's not clean, right? I want the freedom of to say what happens to my body. So shouldn't I extend that to someone else? And I love the point of like, and I also think like, hey, we probably just shouldn't take lives, whether they're mass murderers or unborn babies. And something I learned recently from Seth Godin.
Huge Godin fan.
And he posed this, I learned it probably, it was probably over a year ago, but it's one of my favorite things to talk about, is like, when we don't want to solve problems, make them political.
Yes.
And then so it's like, spot on. You know, I create, you know, it's like, if I create a poison and people start using it and then we find out it's poison and I don't want to have to deal with that I created a poison, just make it a political issue and I can step back and everyone can fight about it.
Oh, forever.
Which is so sad.
Terrible, but accurate. Yes. Yes, it is.
I want to transition a little bit, because we dove into some, thanks for sharing also. I appreciate you saying like the topic that's controversial, but not from like, you didn't bring like, you're all dumb if you don't believe what I believe. You just posed like two ideas and we're like, hey, this is where the issues are. We're not even able to solve them because we're not even talking about the same things.
Right.
Let's talk about investing though. I don't have like a place I really wanna, let's actually start with this. As somebody who was the senior vice president and youngest at a big bank, what were like the, when you went from working from corporate to kind of now being on your own as like an angel investor, what are some of the key things you learned that now empower you to invest from your experience of like being in a system?
Very good question. Wow. A lot to unpack there. So when you're in a large corporate institution, so I worked for Columbia Management at the time, this isn't true any longer, they've since sold it, was Bank of America's asset management arm. So we would manage assets in a particular way, whether it's growth stocks or just focus on healthcare stocks or bonds or what have you, we would manage those for various institutions. And at the time, my customers were Merrill Lynch, UBS, CalPERS, Google, Boeing, UPS, et cetera. So very large institutions would give us a mandate. They would say, hey, we want you to be an asset manager in this particular style, and that's what we're going to add to our portfolio. And so my job was to work with the portfolio managers as to what we thought was going to happen in the world, and then take that information and prophesize it to all of our large institutional customers. So most of the guys I spent time talking to, men and women, were analysts, CFOs, CEOs, you know, decision makers around how to deploy large pools of capital. And what I learned really quickly is that all money is to be made by being the contrarian. And this is really obvious, but the amount of intestinal fortitude that you need to have in order to actually do it, instead of pointing my finger and saying, this is how you do it, let me give you a story about how I didn't do it. So at the time, it's 2008, the sky is falling. Bank of America had just bought Countrywide, which was the junkiest mortgage company in the entire world. Large financial firms such as Bear Stearns, WaMu, and others were failing overnight. It was as bad as it could be. The financial sector, my sector, was down from a percentage 60, 70%, right? My net worth was devastated as most of it was tied into company stock. And then one day we, being Bank of America, woke up and bought my very biggest customer, which at the time was Merrill Lynch. That's not a great thing, right? At the time, it was a terrible thing. I thought, now I can't sell to my own customer. How do I replace my largest customer? And I remember sitting on my sofa, the ticker going, and seeing Citigroup stock at 98 cents. Citigroup stock, 98 cents. I remember sitting there going, Pierre, you don't have the guts to buy it. Because everybody believed that Citigroup and every other financial stock was just going to go out of business, right? Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, Washington Mutual, Countrywide, all of these were going out of business overnight. So why would I take what was left of my net worth, which had already been crushed, take what little cash I had and buy this stock for 98 cents? And I remember sitting there saying, you don't have the guts to buy it. And I was right. I didn't have the guts to buy it. I don't know if you know what Citigroup's at today, but it's not 98 cents. Right. So it's appreciated by a factor of a few thousand since then. Because I wasn't the contrarian in that moment. Right. And so it's very easy for me to sit there and tell you to be a contrarian. It's much more difficult for you to actually do it.
Let's run with what you just shared. For people listening that let's just say they're in the beginning of an investment journey. Maybe they have no investments. Maybe they have a few, like, you know, somebody manages an account, some stocks for them, those kind of things. What advice would you give to somebody who's like, I want to get more into this? You know, is there something you can say, or is there like books to read or places to go learn? How do you open this? How do you crack open this giant world and get yourself into it?
So there's a lot of different ways to invest, right? From traditional stocks, bonds, mutual funds, ETFs. That's usually, I would suggest, first people start. And then you've, of course, got real estate, and you've got more alternative asset classes, startups, which is near and dear to my heart. So I'm not going to get into the modality of doing that because, frankly, there's too many flavors. What I think is more important here is your strategy, which is, what do you care about? What do you care about? Because if you care about it, you'll care to actually follow it. You'll know more about it. You'll use that product, et cetera. And you'll be engaged with that investment because you like whatever it is that they are doing, right? So that is where I would start. So if you're a person who loves technology, maybe you're interested in startups, or maybe you want to own more Facebook and Netflix and other services like that, depending on where you are on the tech spectrum. Maybe you like medical devices, right? Because you have a pacemaker and you find that really interesting, or you have a replacement hip, so you invest in Stryker. Whatever that might be, start with what you like, number one. And number two, figure out what I call the yield to worst, okay? So here's an example. Let's pretend you like Apple products. You're an Apple product fan. You got all their products when they come out. You're the guy who waits in line for the new phone, et cetera. Okay? My challenge question to that person would be, what happens if the new iPhone is a complete flop, like just a mega failure? They don't sell a single unit. How does that change your investment thesis? Well, in the case of Apple, I happen to know a few things about Apple. It actually won't make that much of a difference. They make more of their revenue now from things like the App Store and iTunes, et cetera, than they do selling devices. The devices are the gateway drug for them to make real margin on you, which is the digital products, right? Because digital products have very low cost versus hardware, which costs more. And so you can make a pretty good thesis that they could stink at selling hardware and still crush it because of their digital product software sales. But if you don't care about Apple and you don't care about techie stuff, you just tuned out with everything I just said, right? That's okay. You don't have to like Apple. Don't invest in Apple. Go do what it is that you like to do. Start there. That's the first and foremost. And the next is create scenarios where you believe that things are bad, not good. Don't invest in good markets. Suckers invest in good markets. Smart people invest in bad markets. So if you like to travel, what I would do if you like to travel is invest in travel stocks now. Because who's traveling now? No one. Airlines are crushed. Carnival Cruise Lines is devastated, right? Hotel chains are hurt. Restaurant groups are hurt. This is the time, if you're the person who loves to go out and travel and go to different places and fly and stay in a hotel, that's your passion, then you're going to know more about airlines. You're going to have a favorite airline. You're going to have a favorite hotel chain. And that is going to increase your likelihood of being knowledgeable. And because it's a terrible market, you're going to be buying that stuff at a great discount. So that's how I would start that journey.
And you're right. It does make it a lot more fun too when you're looking at, you know, when I started looking at buying a Peloton, I never looked at Peloton stock. I didn't even think of Peloton as a company that would have stock. Right. But I remember like when I started looking at like, oh, I want to get a Peloton because everything got shut down. And then I started seeing all the people that I know are getting Pelotons. Now, the people I know is not the biggest community in the world, right? But the people I know have a decent amount of money. Like, they're not rich, but they're not poor. They're I want to say they're like kind of true middle class, mm-hmm. or upper middle class. They care about health. They like technology. They're forward thinking. They're trying to get better jobs and do things. And I was like, well, if we're all buying Pelotons, it's right. Like, it really speaks, right? Then I went, right. And one day I was like sitting there and I like looked up Peloton stock and I was like, I happen to be late on this. I caught it late, just like how my Peloton didn't show up for 4 months because they were so busy. But it's a great lesson, right? Like I could have, the lesson is like when I first noticed it, I could have actually looked because it was like $30 a share. And then over the course of the pandemic, it went up 3 times. It was at 90. And then even at 90, I was like, it can't. And now, I don't know what it is now, but it was like 120 or something. But the point is, every time I look at my social media, every single person is getting a Peloton. So who's to say that this is where it ends? And to your point, it's like, is it the bike or is it whatever the bike's going to get you into? Because now there's an app and there's a treadmill and I'm correct. Sure there's going to be, I have to think this company is like, there's going to be the next thing and the next thing, right? Apple started with a computer and it's evolved. And Peloton is not an exercise company. It's a I think it's a technology company.
It's a streaming company. Absolutely.
It's a what?
It's a streaming company.
Okay.
Right. It's a technology company, right? They make their money. They don't make their money selling you the hardware, kind of like Apple. They make the hardware is the gateway drug. They make their money on the subscription service you have to pay to get the lessons in order for you to actually use the device. The hardware is just the modality in which you can engage with their streaming service and keep you hooked.
Yeah.
So that's Netflix. That's Hulu, right? Like that's what you want to think about your investments and distill them down to their core. So let's talk about Tinder for a second, or Bumble. What is Tinder? You say, oh, it's a dating app. No, it's not. It's a marketing company. Or what do they market? They broker the relationship between two like-minded individuals, mm-hmm. right? So their job isn't to do anything other than get a lot of human beings to fill out a profile and be on Tinder. Mm-hmm. That's a marketing company. That's not a technology company. Mm-hmm. Their technology is pretty basic, doesn't do anything that's really all that impressive. What they have done that's been impressive is acquire customers in bulk.
Yeah.
Right? That's been very impressive. They have done the same thing with Tinder that Uber has done. Uber's done the same thing that Airbnb has done. They've created a two-sided platform where the two parties are negotiated on a contract, whether it's a date, whether it's a house or a ride to the airport. It's all the same, dude. It's all the same. You have to think about it like, oh, wow, you're right. Those companies are exactly the same. They're just marketing verticals within a niche. One marketing vertical is dating. One is transportation. And one is hospitality. But effectively, they're marketing companies. They don't own any of the physical products, right?
Yeah.
So start distilling down what these businesses are to really this super simplistic basic thing. So if you were going to explain it to a 10-year-old, start there. And if you can do that, it will actually give you clarity as to their ability to be successful in the future.
I love that. I love that. Like I've never actually thought of dating apps as a marketing, but you're spot on right there. It's, and also the idea that like you can make all this money and actually not really own anything. Like there is a service, they do provide something. There are a lot of businesses that operate that way. Like even mm-hmm. consultants and coaches have been operating that way forever, right? They're not giving you any tangible thing. They're giving you essentially wisdom, knowledge, support. I'm curious about for people that, you know, you talked about startups. And I know, mm-hmm. I remember when I started learning about Tim Ferriss a few years ago, I remember him talking about how he kind of really his career really like kicked off with investing in startups that really like opened the door for a lot of other things. I've shared at the beginning, like I had put some money in one startup, but something I noticed is like, man, I would like to invest in more startups. I don't know how, I don't know where to find them, but also like, do I have enough money to do that? Right? Like your point with the stock market, you don't need a lot. You could have $100 and invest in the stock market and put that company like Robinhood or whatever makes it so even if you have like $5, you could invest in the stock market.
Right.
But when it comes to like startups, can you give me a little like could I, you know, if I had $5,000, could I get in on a startup? Like what, how does that world work?
Yeah. So now you're talking about my favorite things to talk about, right? Cool. So I think that startups are the most interesting, exciting, best place to be. I obviously am biased to that because that's my background. But when you are thinking about the difference between investing in Apple versus the difference between investing in a startup, you make $100,000 investment, $1 million investment, a $10 million investment in Apple. What did that do to Apple stock? Nothing. Zero. Right? You make $100,000 investment in a startup, game changer. Right? Massive. Let's take money out of the equation. You like Apple, you tell five of your Android friends they got to buy an iPhone and they all buy iPhones. What difference did that make to Apple? Zero. You invested in a startup, but you get five referrals. Very meaningful. Very meaningful. So in startup land, you as an investor can actually help your own investment returns, right? You in some way can take control of that. And that to me is super rewarding outside of the obvious financial benefits. How can you do it? There's a lot of different ways that you can invest within startups. The ways that I recommend, you can go to a website called Net Capital. Net Capital, you can invest in startup deals because of an interesting thing that happened called the Jobs Act. So not to bore everybody, but the Jobs Act basically said that you as an unaccredited investor, regular Joe Blow, can now invest in startups. So it's something that you could never do before. So now all these platforms have popped up like Seed Invest, Start Engine, Republic, and Net Capital to be able for you, an unaccredited investor, to invest a very small amount. I mean, you could literally invest $30, $40, $50 into these various startups. Now, if you want to level up from there, you can check out angellist.com and you can see actually Tim Ferriss's portfolio and other very intelligent people in the startup community and what investments they've made. And you can invest alongside with them in those deals. you want to level up from there, there are other avenues that you can go down where you become what's called an LP, a limited partner, in a venture capital fund. And there are lots of different venture capital funds throughout the United States, depending on what you're trying to accomplish. Some have low minimums, some have enormously high minimums, and it really depends on their expertise and their speciality.
That's really cool. Thanks for, like Net Capital, Seed Invest, Angel List. So these are places though that, let's just say the average human, the average person can at least start exploring. They might have the money, they might not have the money, but it could actually give them an idea of how they could get involved.
Yes.
Is there a show or a podcast or something that you would recommend for people that are like, hey, I do want to learn more about this? Maybe even just following you like on your social media, but where is maybe a place that you would just recommend that people go?
So my number one favorite podcast about this is Reid Hoffman. Reid Hoffman has a podcast. If you don't know who Reid Hoffman is, he founded LinkedIn. He was actually an early employee to PayPal. Had a very successful exit with PayPal, started LinkedIn, had an enormously successful exit with LinkedIn when LinkedIn was purchased by Microsoft. And then he went on to become a general partner at Greylock. Greylock is one of the best VCs in the entire world, right? Mm-hmm. So smart guy. He has incredibly high-end or well-known startup founders on his show. Right. So Sarah Blakely, who invented Spanx, Mark Zuckerberg. Right. So he has all of them on there. And those are great stories and it's super well produced. There are many other podcasts that are focused on that space, but that's one of my favorites. Another one is Jason Calcanis. He also has a great podcast within the startup space. Two other areas that I would recommend non-podcasty is Quora. Go to Quora, sign up. It's free, obviously. Look into the VC entrepreneur startup space, right? Add that to your preferences and start reading. Your ability to engage and interface with high-level startup founders and VCs there is very high. And the other place where that group of people can be found is Twitter. For whatever reason, the VC community loves, they're obsessed with Twitter. So Paul Graham, if you don't know who Paul Graham is, he started Y Combinator. Y Combinator's the most important incubator of startups in the United States. They incubated Airbnb famously and many, many others. Paul's on Twitter like 6 hours a day. So you want to talk to Paul, you're never going to get him on the phone. He's never going to respond to an email. You can tweet him and he'll respond to you quick, right? So you can get to these people.
Yeah. Dude, I just realized like our time has like flown by, which is a great thing because it means I'm having a good time at least and I'm learning. So I could have this conversation with you for so much longer, and I know how you have so much more value. I do want to have you share, do you have a few more minutes?
Yeah, I've got another 15 minutes.
Okay, cool. Cause I do want to have you share one thing that I know about you. And it's totally different, but it's moving out of your house at 16 into a cabin without electric or hot water.
Yeah.
Can you, I just, what do you want to share? What do we need to know about this?
Look, so I believe firmly that life happens for you and it doesn't happen to you. Okay. Now, with that being said, never met my dad. Don't know him. Actually don't know his name. My mom, unfortunately, my mother still has a strong alcohol addiction. And so at a young age, 12, 13, 14 years old, you figure out that being home is not a great place to be. It's very volatile. Mm. It's just not great. And so I would oftentimes at a very young age, 13, 14 years old, literally grab my dog in a tent at 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night and just head off into the woods and go camping for the night, because camping by myself at 13 years old, starting a fire, cooking my own food, doing all that was safer than being at home, right? Which was just crazy and volatile. And so as a father now, I look at that and go, oh my gosh, that's so crazy. I'm like camping and by myself. No one knows where I am. My mom doesn't know where I am. I go in a different direction. It's craziness. So as I got a little bit older and I got a driver's license, I said, you know what? I just can't be here. like this, I have to take myself out of this environment. It's terrible. I literally slept in the basement, not because I didn't have my own room. I had my own room, but I chose to sleep in the basement because I was out of sight, out of mind at my home. So I move into this cabin, and it was a cabin that my family had owned since the 50s. This is not anything fancy. Okay. This is a small cabin in the middle of the woods.
Where was this?
Northern New Hampshire.
So it's cold in the winter too. This is not like a cabin in Southern California.
No, it's very cold in the wintertime. So gas lights, no hot water heater. The toilet had to be charged on a car battery. It was like an RV toilet. Just so that it would flush. Most people in that little area that had cabins, there's a handful of cabins there, were outhouses. And so at 16 years old, I had to boil water on the stove to wash my dishes. I mean, it sounds like I'm talking about the 1800s, but this was just 20 years ago. I had to have a gym membership in order to get a shower. I had to keep the wood stoves going just so I didn't freeze at night. It was a way to become independent on a whole new level, right? But here's the greatest gift that was given to me. The thing that I might treasure more than maybe anything, which is it puts this chip on my shoulder and a fire in my belly to say that if I fail, if I swing hard and I miss hard, like I get kicked in the teeth, like everything goes to zero, right? I lose the house, I lose the wife, I lose the car, I lose all my money, I lose all my business, I zero, zero, zero. I know that in here, I already know how bad it can be. I have practiced as extreme of poverty as I can get, as a human can get in the United States. So the way I approach it is, come at me. Come at me. You can't do worse to me. I've already experienced it. I know how not bad it really is. I know that I can get through it. And that gives you this level of sort of braggadocious confidence where when bad shit happens, sorry for the language, you just go, now it's on. Like I get excited when things get stressful and difficult because I've been through so much worse. So I don't want people to go, woe is me or pity. I want people to go, wow, that's the lesson there. That is this bucket of fuel that I just attack the world with because I know you can knock me down 100%. You can knock me down 10 more times. I've already been there. It don't matter to me, right? So it gives you this like I'm getting goosebumps just talking about it because I get so charged up. I'm like, it literally makes me want to like just charge into the fight. It's the best thing that ever happened.
Thanks for sharing that story and like sharing the circumstances too, because I think it's a great, like it kind of brings us around full circle to where we started, which is like how you can view every situation. Nobody, no child deserves or should be in a situation like that, or, you know, rape, abuse, molestation, like there we could go. There's lots of situations that are terrible and nobody deserves that. And nobody should be. And even it's just like, if it's you're poor and dirty and don't have any money and there's no one to take care of you and you don't have food. And it's pretty amazing to hear, like you took yourself out of it. And it's not to say that everyone can do that, right? Everyone's situation is different. Everyone mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily have a cabin to go to, mm-hmm. but there was still a choice. There's a lot of, you could have easily chose to stay in that bedroom and suffer, became an alcoholic yourself, like mm-hmm. a million ways. And ultimately, I mean, I'm a strong believer that life is about choice. So it doesn't, you can have everything and make horrible choices, and you can have nothing and make great choices. And it doesn't mean at any point we go from like 0 to 10. We might go from 0 to 1 and then 0 to 2. And it might be a long journey to get us out of the horribleness we're in. But if we're willing to make choices in service of improvement, it can happen and it's possible. Yes. Thanks for sharing that. I can't even imagine. Like I said, I have had like a very privileged, lucky, I look back at my childhood and I'm like, how did not bad stuff happen to me? Like I'm like, is it all getting saved up for one really bad? You know, I feel like very, and as a kid, I didn't know this, right? Like I just like, but when I'm an adult, I look back at my childhood, and I'm like, fuck, I was lucky, comparatively speaking, right? When you start to understand what other people dealt with. Mm-hmm. So thanks for sharing that. And, and getting that, like how much it matters and using it to your success now and to benefit your family and your teams and the people you invest in. Pierre, I want to tell people how they can like find you and where they can go. We didn't even get to talk about Yayin, your company, but I want to give people like a place to go, which first of all, they can go to your website, which is Pierre Rogers, P-I-E-R-R-E, Rogers, R-O-G-E-R-S.com. On Instagram, they can find you at P-U-R-O-R-O-G-E-R-S. Do you say that like Pierre Rogers?
Got it.
Cool. Anywhere else, like if people want more of you, I know you have like you're giving away a magnum bottle of Cristal. What
we are, yes.
how do people try to get that?
If you want to check that out, it's a magnum bottle of Cristal with a champagne saber. So okay. That if you really want to pop bottles like gangster style, you can do it. And it's on yayin.com. That's yahyn.com. Yayin.com. And, it's a wine company that I spend most of my time working with. That's a lot of fun. And we are doing a fun giveaway over there. We actually just gave away a case of Dom Perignon just a few weeks ago, a whole case. We like to do things big here. We like to do things kind of crazy. So a bottle of Cristal wasn't good enough. We got the Magnum, which is a double bottle for those of you who don't know what a Magnum is, and a huge champagne shit saber so you can show off and have a great time. So we're all about celebrating life, man. So check it out.
That's awesome. Hey, thanks for being here. Thanks for giving me extra time sharing not only your personal stories, but just your wisdom. And I learned a ton. And like I said, this time flew by. So I might have to get my team on getting you back and digging in more. But I so appreciate you today.
Thank you so much. I had a blast and I'd love to be on again. I love talking about this stuff. You hit a nerve for me. This is my favorite thing to do.
Thanks, man. If everyone listening, please check out Pierre Rogers, find him online, go to his website, go to yayin.com. It's Yahyn. See if you can get that saber and that magnum bottle. And please share this episode with a friend, share it with somebody who needs to hear maybe that come up story or learn something about investing. And I appreciate you. Stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Honestly, I'm just a rebel who found a cause and has a dream, and I'm super grateful for your support. If you got anything from this, please help me out and share this podcast with one person today. You can find me at thedreammason.com or at inspirationalalex on Instagram. You are a dream mason because your dreams don't build themselves.